All right, we're on. Well, this morning, I've got a special guest in the studio, Mr. John Buchanan. Now, John will be best known to a lot of people as his role as coach of the Australian cricket team. But John's also gone on to, go after a number of other major roles, including back to school now as well. And John also works in high performance coaching, but obviously, as I was saying to John before we go on the air, you don't just wake up and find yourself at the top of the table, do you, John?
No, you don't. There's a few jumps, hurdles, acceleration points along
And what I guess I'd love to do is I'd love to start with you as a young man. If I've done my research correctly, I understand you went to the Southport School
the way. That's
as a young fellow.
correct. That's correct. It was many moons ago, when Southport, the Gold Coast, was regarded as a country town. It was an hour and a half's drive on a single lane highway to Brisbane. And I remember sitting in the back seat of my parents' car, which they had various cars, but one of the first ones was an old Vanguard. And as you went along the highway, you looked at all the other cars coming the other way. Presumably we got past every so often, but a lot of the cars coming the other way, and you knew virtually every car on the road, and how could you do it these days? And it's not single lane, and there's multiple lanes, and there's multiple vehicles, and there's multiple models. But anyway, so that's a bit of a reflection back to the time, I suppose. And it was a wonderful place to grow up. Southport School was a much smaller school then than it is now. Some probably 550 boys thereabouts, and 60 day boys. I was a day boy. Began there in grade six, I think, grade six, and then went through to grade 12, repeated grade 12, and then on to university after that.
And at school, was cricket your main game or were you into something else?
Cricket was my passion, but played first 15 footy, or rugby, I should say. Played seconds tennis. And was in the sort of athletic squad, but cricket was always a passion. As a day boy, and I was a single child, so my parents would always, where they could, bring out one or two of the boarders of a weekend. And the boarders generally got, I think, a couple of Sundays a month for one day, and then once a month, I think they'd stay overnight. So grade six onwards, there was a good group of young boys, of which still two of them to this day are very close and good friends, probably, as you or probably the best mates, because you've been through a lot of things at school, but other things, post-schooling life with them. So we'd be playing plenty of backyard test cricket. My father had built a netting system based out of prawn trawler nets and old TV antenna poles, and put them in the ground so that we could actually roll them up and put them one side, so then he could go out and do the garden. But they were there to protect the garden, protect the windows, and create a test cricket environment for us. And using the old ABC cricket books, hat, pieces of paper which had names on them, we draw the various players into your teams, and then away we go. And generally, whoever you play for, in other words, is your team, and if you were batting, you had to pretty well try and bat like that batsman. So right-handed, you bat a right-hand, left-handed, you bat a left-handed, vice versa with the bowler. So that's how the test matches went, and they started as soon as the boys got there and continued right up to the point where they had to return to the school.
That actually sounds pretty serious. You've got to tell me when do you remember cricket standing out to you? When do you remember noticing it? No, that's
Probably a couple of years earlier than that. We were in just a small sort of low-set apartment lock, and I recall listening to my parents' radio, which is in their room, with just one of those old radio sets, and being able to turn on Australia playing England in England, and would have been probably 1961, thereabouts, I think, the tour that that's where Simpson scored his first 100, and it was 311 at Old Trafford, if I recall correctly. So that was some of my first recollections of international cricket and dreaming about, wow, how special would that be? And, you know, that thing was fueled by then going, well, in fact, probably trying to make the state school, because Southport State, because the state school was quite good, the Southport State School cricket team that would play on a Friday afternoon at TSS. They played at the TSS Omni School 11, and at Southport State School, they played on the schools, but it was about going to Southport School. And just remember being so disappointed virtually every time, trying to go to the Nets, trying to get into the side. And I might have made it one time, you know. So it was both disappointing, but also probably challenged me to want to be there. And then once I, my parents placed me at the Southport School, then cricket was on tap. And now there were more Nets. There were teachers who were coaching cricket. And so, yeah, that really began to fuel the interest. And I was good enough to make the A sides, but I was just one of the numbers, really. For a number of years till, you know, somehow the skills, the coaching, the interest all allowed me then to play first level cricket.
Because in most cases, it's that dedication, you know, and probably not getting it straight away. Where you've really got to fight for it. That seems to make a fairly considerable difference.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you just mentioned in the intro that I'm back actually coaching one of the Brisbane Chippers. So I've had Chippers competition on the Brisbane side, who's on Brisbane Boys College. And we had a pretty good season. We finished up third. We had 6 wins and a couple of losses. And, but in that side, there are 2 or 3 very good players, of which one has probably a little bit more talent than the rest, but I suspect he's been gifted with that talent for a long time, and as a result, sometimes people overlook that individual because they're good at what they're doing, and therefore they don't necessarily get the coaching, as you say, they don't necessarily have the graft that everybody else has to employ to, one, get in the side, and then, two, remain in the side. So his consistency, both in training and both in games, is quite a roller coaster. Whereas a couple of the other boys who are quite talented, their performances are a little bit more less up and down, and they work in the game. And so it's the same. We all have certain gifts and certain abilities, but that's not going to necessarily help you succeed in whatever your endeavours are alone. There needs to be, you know, a commitment. There needs to be that desire to be better. There needs to be experimentation. There needs to be the lack of success. And then how do I overcome that? There needs to be success to help fuel the fires, you know. So for me, cricket, you know, and sport, but cricket in particular, is a really good medium to have people understand that about the individual, about yourself, but also then how that actually combines itself with a whole other group of individuals in a thing called a team.
And I think the personal development is one of my favourite things about sport. You know, the fact that, you know, the self-discipline and those sorts of things, you know, can be carried along with the team for a point.
unless you decide to put in that individual work, it's over.
Yes, and look, I just mentioned a couple of boys that are still my best mates who were in those cricket teams, and I just, and they were boarders, and I just recall how determined one of them was to be that cricketer, to be a state cricketer, possibly be a test cricketer, and sitting in underneath it, he just didn't have the skills. His determination was so I was, he would train almost day and night if he could to do that. But unfortunately, just his skill level was never there. Yet he took those traits, those characteristics, became a school captain, went on to do engineering, got an MBA, eventually became just recently retired from the board of BHP, was CEO and chairman of Orica, and just a hugely successful business person based on just those same characteristics that he demonstrated as a young schoolboy.
That dogged determination that you learn, it's one of my favourite things that I've seen. You know, I saw it in myself because, you know, I was not particularly gifted, but I knew what I wanted. And the lack of gifts was what taught me that I had to work 10 times harder than anybody else. And even right down to the wire, like my dream I saw rowing when I was a young bloke, I saw the boat, I'm like, I don't know what that is, but I want to do that. And I can't even explain to you why. But that picture in my head, and you know, and even though this is a long time ago, that moment where I, you know, accepted my first name, after, you know, even down the right to after that for the second, but again, you know, you fight your way back. You don't realise at the time what you are creating in yourself, that, you know, you build that picture in your head and then you just work right from it. And I had no idea the foundations that was lying for that, because you can't appreciate as a young person just how difficult it's going to be. You sort of look at adults and you go, hey, they've got a killer, they've got money in their pocket, oh, it's easy. And, you know, I laugh at my friends. It's not quite like it, it was explained to us in the brochure. You get there and actually it's a surprising amount of work.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You mentioned an interesting thing there about the picture in your head, right? And, you know, again, as I said, I was an only child. So in the backyard, I created dream after dream after dream. So whether it was the cricket season and I was out there by myself, you know, with the ball on the clothesline or ball against the back wall of the barbecue, you know, a stump. I was just creating games and images and, stories, I guess, for myself. And then if it was rugby season, then, you know, / rugby league, I was out there, you know, on the wing or forward or, you know, kicking chase, whatever it was, and so on. So I think that was the beginnings when I look back prior to me taking on a role as coach of the Queensland cricket team, which was mid-90s. When I look back at that point in time to how do I coach or what do I do when I coach? One of the important things has always been that vision, that picture, that dream, because the dream to me is where you would love to be, whether that's an individual or a team, but where you really aspire to be. And so if you've got that picture, then well, how do I get there? Or where am I now? How do I get there? And so that has always been, I guess, a very strong element of my coaching, certainly my own life, you know, because the dreams come and go, as you know, your picture about rowing, right? And you got there in the first day. Having left school, I'm sure you created some other pictures as I did. My dream was still so long as I could keep it going, I still play cricket for Australia. But that dream evaporated, and so then it was a new dream, and then that one moved on, and then there was the next. So I was always, I guess, looking into the future about what the future could be for me, and then, you know, family and marriage and all that sort of thing for us. And so then, as I said, coming into that Queensland coaching job, then that was very much an important part of what I was going to bring into that environment.
But before we jump forward then, because you were saying obviously you sort of played A-grade and then you were looking to try and push that as far as you could, would you mind telling me a little bit about that story? Because obviously a few things happened there between, you know, making that A-side, you know, having that dream of Aggie Gray. Could you tell me a little bit about that time?
Once I left school, you know, I was at the university and played for the University Cricket Club, and I seemed to be this pretty talented young player, fresh out of school, who would naturally find his way into the first 11 team at university and join fairly illustrious rank of players, because two of them had played for Australia. Tom Booth is probably the most recognised, and then a number of people played for Queensland at that stage, and then virtually went through club cricket and they had already started players, because that's the way it was in those days. So that didn't necessarily transpire the way it should do, because my first game for Union, first grade, was a duck. So that didn't quite start out the way that I thought it would, so I found my way back into the second, you know, probably struggled along for a while, and then went into Colts, which was, took me back into Premier Grade, but away from the university, because Costing, which was a selection of talented young players, put them together and under the auspices of a former player. In fact, probably 10 years later, maybe 12 years later, I took on that role as well, where you were a captain coach and looked after a whole group of young players, of which my vice captain at that stage was Ian Healy. So the notion was that you put that sort of experienced player to help guide and coach and supposed to direct the younger group of players. So anyway, I found myself into that cult side, but again, unsuccessful with the bat, so I found my way out of that cult side and back into reserve grade. So, but I still hadn't lost this dream of playing cricket for Australia, even though things weren't quite panning out the way that I thought they would. And so eventually I found my way back into first grade, but not as a batsman. I came back as a bowler, and then gradually from bowling I became an all-rounder, and then there was a pack series. And so there were openings in the Queensland side to play for Queensland, of which I was given the opportunity to do so in the late 70s, which is the last year of Packer. And I remember my first innings with the guest Tasmania in a one-day game at the Gabba, and I made 60-odd. There was a young bloke debuting the same guy for Tasmania, but I made a day debut. And the season sort of flowed on, and again, quite go the way that I thought it might. And by the end of the season, and I'd been overseas at that stage, playing professional cricket in England, for Holden and then Cambridge here, and the second year I'd taken my wife-to-be over to experience that, come back, played for Queensland. When the Packer players came back, I found, well, I really didn't believe in himself. So I've been sort of given the evidence that maybe your skills are not there by pretty ordinary 6 or 7 games for Queensland. And then the Packer boys came back, so Chappell, Thompson, Martin Kent, and a few others around the Queensland mix. And that, in my mind, really showed me that, no, I'm not up to the standard. I also had a bit of injury going on, so it was then time to say, right, well, hang up the boots, you know, let that dream go on and now move on to something else. But again, it was going forward to that time as applying for the coaching role for Queensland. It was those experiences that, also fueled my, I think, insight into coaching, insofar as going back to our early conversations, there were a lot of players that had some ability but didn't appreciate them, and it wasn't appreciated also by others around them. And so the role of the coach was into really understanding individuals as much as possibly could, so that it wasn't just a coaching system for all, it was a coaching system for each individual. That's that within a team framework. So, you know, just really important lessons for me as a coach, not that I understood those at the time.
Well, I think that was where I was very interested to leave that question, was what inside you went, okay, I'm going to try coaching. You know, playing, I love it, I want to do it, but it's just not quite for me. But you clearly didn't want to leave the game. I'm interested in understanding that thought process of how you got to applying to be a coach.
Yes, well, it wasn't a straight line.
I bet it wasn't.
Not at all. So, as I said, once I decided to retire from playing, albeit that I didn't quite retire because I went to council to become a recreation officer for the city council up there, and so then I was selected in the Queensland country teams, and I was captain of the Queensland country teams, and you know, we played some representative games, but I'd lost the fire inside, and so while it was a privilege to be selected and play, I didn't want to be out there. But having played for Queensland and going to the country, you know, it was almost an expectation that that's what you do. That's how you help Queensland country cricket. So is there more fulfilling everybody else's dreams and goals than anyway. So I thought that dream that was becoming a sports administrator, Commonwealth Games, came along and I came back with my wife from North Queensland to be part of the Commonwealth Games administration. National Director of Volleyball, and so sports administration seemed to be the way to go. But they moved the office into Canberra and we'd just kind of settled, young family just starting, so not going to go to Canberra. And so then I went into TAFE, got a diploma of teaching and started teaching in TAFE for a couple of years, but found that I couldn't really connect with the students that I was teaching. So these were 15, 16-year-old boys and girls who at school were told physically, academically, socially, emotionally, that they were dropouts. They found their way to TAFE at the time, but the government said, well, you've got to take these numbers away from them. The statistics, and so we're going to create these pre-vocational courses where we bring all our students into TAFE, and they will learn or at least be exposed to a whole range of trades, but also we'll give them this kind of holistic approach around their physical and mental development. So that's kind of where I fit into the picture from a previous degree and education. And totally worthwhile, except I had the silver spoon from the private school days. These young boys and girls certainly didn't have any silver spoon, and therefore my ability to really help them and relate to them was not what it should be. So anyway, like teaching, like sports, so we decided, right, well, I'll be a lecturer at a university, and there was a position going at Griffiths University. So this is now in the sort of mid-80s. But they said, you've got to get a master's degree. So wrote to US unis and Canadian universities and was given a scholarship to a Canadian university. And so we took two very young children, and my wife and I, and off we went. family accommodation over there, which is an incredible experience. It was just because you had people from all around the world. And just completely different because it was at the University of Alberta, Edmonton, minus 36 in winter, and just a very short summer. But an amazing experience. And so that all looked good, all looked rosy. Here we are, getting this degree and go back to Shriver's. A lecturer at Griffith University, but the chap who had said that there would be a role coming up in 1998, thereabouts, he said there's somebody else that's got the role because they've got a degree before you, but he said there's a job going in Canberra. So I came back in 1988. My wife stayed here in Brisbane and she had our third child, so I headed off to Canberra and started lecturing at the University, well, of course, Canberra CA, and then changed to the University of Canberra. So I did that, and so that, again, there was the next dream, you know, so it was about, wow, I'll be a professor, and great academic life, lots of holidays, like teaching, being around sport, because I was teaching sports studies and sports marketing, sports coaching, sports admin, and areas that I really quite enjoyed. But the rules changed. The rules said that once you became a university, you needed a PhD rather than a master's. But, all right, okay, let's give this PhD a crack, which I did for 6 months and then just realised I cannot study anymore. And also, I didn't want to be an expert in the top of a opinion. Because, you know, PhD is all about peeling in back till you get to the nub of the argument or the question or your hypothesis. And so eventually found a job back in Brisbane, which was with the Department of Tourism, Sport and Racing. And I was managing a children's sports program for Aussie Sports, which was all about providing young children with the best possible experiences of fun and enjoyment when they're exposed to different sporting activities. And so with a young family, I thought this was, I mean, one, I understood the whole concept of it, but two, it was so relevant. And so I did that for a couple of years, and then the federal government pulled their funding, so that program was cut. I was still within the department. And again, the dream was, well, you know, probably said it was not too bad. I'll just stay in here and gradually work my way to the top. You know, that seemed a reasonable piece of logic. But the more I stayed in the public service, the more I realised it was, for those who wanted to treat it more, you know, more of a vocation, if you like, rather than just a place where you go and get your paycheck and then you leave. Wasn't necessarily the place to be. And then, of course, this Queensland job came up. So I decided that I'll have a run at that. Ian Healy was obviously captain of Queensland at the time, so I spoke with him a little bit about if I had a, you know, hypothetically, if I had a run at this and I'm successful, would you, and Alan Border was about to go off about the next season and finish playing for Australia. And other players like Brackman, Tasler, Barsfield, a lot of old players in that side, Stuart Law, who played for Australia, and he was going to be captain. Would you give me the go? Because Jeff Thompson, who was a legend in Australia, he had been coach for 4 years, but I'm kept. Would you just give me a go? It's a year, so got to demonstrate the coach. So that was kind of the circuitous route for me becoming a coach, because to go and sit in that interview room, to be asked why I should be given the coaching reins when Jeff Thompson and all the other applicants had this incredible career pedigree and I had that really awful 1 year for Queensland, how could I stack up against them? And so that really forced me then to go back to my early childhood, go back to the parents, go back to the school, go back to the university club and all the good things and poor things that I saw in how you develop individuals, how you develop teams, of which I've had experience firsthand, both good and bad. And so in the intervening years, what had I done? You know, how did I go about my coaching? Because I did still have, you know, some involvement in career, but also outside of career, when I was working with a group of people, how have I worked with them? How have I understood them? And then, of course, the family. How does that sort of fit into this thing called coaching? So wrapping all that up and putting all that together, then I took that into the...
I'm glad we went back, because you weren't keen. You said that was a wiggly line.
Yeah, sorry, it's a bit of a long...
It speaks so much to the, you know, even the type of person that you are, you know, for, you know, when they the first time today. But, you know, you come across as very, very considerate, you know, take the time to listen and understand. And now hearing, you know, the intricacies of that journey and how you are inevitably destined to end up in Canberra despite trying to avoid it. That's probably one of my favourite parts of that little story. So you're in the room with them. How did that go? How did that interview go?
Well, obviously it went pretty well because I got the job.
Did it feel like that at the time though, or did they really, really?
They did, but I suppose really what I tried to do was run the agenda. And that was simply that if all they wanted to do was win the Holy Grail, Queensland never won the Sheffield Shield, 69 years of trying, and I've been part of that in 1 year. If that's what they wanted to do, then I didn't think I was the coach. But I said, if you want Queensland to dominate domestic cricket for the next 10 years, and somewhere in there, I think we'll win a Shield, then I'm the coach, and then this is how we'll go about it. It's about systems, processes, leadership. We introduce computers, different training regimes, merging squads, a whole range of different things that I thought if we can begin to get this right, then if and when we win a Shield, we will have a better idea how we did that so we can then replicate. As it turned out, we won it the first year, and as I say, a bit of the rest is history. But what it did do was enable us then to understand better about this whole process of the results winning, but the process of winning. While we didn't win the Shield the next year, I mean, it's a good trivia question, I think, is that who was the first coach to lose Queensland the Sheffield Shield or be involved with Queensland losing the Shield? First time. We were able to win it back the next year. We won a couple of Monday titles, and then in the process of doing all that, and I didn't, again, have the dream of coaching Australia. In fact, you know, the dream was still about just continuing to coach Queensland, continuing to build upon success. But tempering that was always the fact that I believe coaches, leaders have a shelf life. And you need to not extend the shelf life when it's obvious that the shelf life is limited. So I was fortunate that after 5 years with Queensland, and I experimented by going to England for one of those years, Middlesex, County Cricket Club, had seen what we were doing, and they were a very successful club some 15 years ago, and they just said, well, we like what you're doing, come and do the same for us. And so I thought I could sandwich the two together. I thought I could coach Queensland, I thought I could coach Middlesex, and because the cities are obviously complementary. But I found, when I look back, that was not possible the way that I should have done it. And so what I was doing was really forcing the issues. And one of those issues was your relationship with your captain, and I was not able to forge that properly in Middlesex, and so that really brought about my undoing at that point in time. But it was, you know, it was very hard to cope with then, but it was a good learning experience. Just again about the whole process of coaching, the whole process about team building, different people, different cultures, different ways of leading, all those sorts of things, you know. So I think that certainly helped, again, moving into the Australian office just over in 99.
There's a way that I guess the way that I understand that is that when you tried to split yourself between two top tier roles, because they're not, you know, it's not turning the sausages on the weekend, you know, that's a full time commitment. Is that what you're sort of feeling? Because you needed 100%, which realistically would only be 50 a week or thereabouts.
Pretty much, I think. I mean, and then look, other people may very well be able to do that, but the way that I coach, I found in hindsight that, you know, I couldn't do it. I couldn't really spend the time with individuals, with culture, with process, with systems, if I was just finishing one season and then I had about 3 weeks pre-season with Middlesex before we mounted the season. And while that seemed like that went really well, you know, one of the interesting stories there was that in that Middlesex side, they had three English players, Mark Ramprakash, who was captain Middlesex for the first year because there was an icon of English and Middlesex cricket who retired from the captaincy, who was still going to play, Mike Gowdy. But in the current English side then was Mark Ramprakash, Angus Frazer, Phil Cuffin. And so they were away playing in the West Indies, and we had this pre-season camp in Spain, as you do. And that worked pretty well because it was really about trying to change the way that people put their club together. So, for example, they had a system then, and this is 98, they had a system then that if you weren't a cap player, meaning the club had recognised for your services to the club, and generally that probably happens after 2 or 3 years, that you become a cap player. And so that means your contracts go up a little bit, you get, you know, travel around the countryside, you generally get your own room, and you get a few other allowances because you're a cap player. But if you're an uncapped player, then you were designated uncapped because on your blazer there was a Roman numeral 2, on your cap there was a Roman numeral 2. And as an example, for me, I said, we're all in this together and we're going to get rid of the visible designations of cap versus uncapped. We're all playing together. And so that was kind of one example, and we did a whole range of other things about the way we wanted to play and how we would go about our preparations and so on. And then the English players came back. And so we had a playing day where we brought the English players in and gave them the opportunity to either add, modify or listen to what we've done over in Spain. And then it was, right, we'll summarise all this and that's our kind of charter and our mantra and our principles of the play the season. All done. All finished, everybody goes, apart from the club coach and the captain. And as I said, my friend coach was the captain. I'd only met him, well, I hadn't met him face to face. I had a couple of phone calls prior to him going to the West Indies because he was sort of welcoming me at that stage. So this is great, good to have you on board and good to meet him when I come back. And the club coach and the captain wants to speak to you. So we were only separated by a couple of metres, but Mark didn't come over and say, hi, how are you doing? No, club coach came over and said, the captain wants to speak to you. Okay. What is it you've got to say? And his words were, you don't make any changes in this club. The players don't make any changes in this club. If there are any changes to be made, I make them. So that was kind of the opening gambit. And so, in a sense, everything that we kind of put in place or were talking about, Roman numerals, all that sort of stuff, he was saying, no, not on. So at that point, I thought, right, I'm not going to get into debating. I think what I can do is gradually get him to understand, you know, better for the team and therefore better for him, because his main goal was to get back into the remaining industry and not be, have to be concerned about anything that's happening in the county level. So what is all me doing is complicating life for him. Whereas I'm trying to convince him that if we can do this, we will uncomplicate your life and hopefully give you better access to that English team, because I think we'll be reasonably successful and that should play well into your CV, if you like, and the way that you get selected. However, that just didn't transpire. And we just kept clashing and you know, sporting thing, if the captain and the coach are not getting along, then it doesn't take long for the dressing room to feel the tension, and that's what happened. And then basically the team did not play all that well, and so the season came along, and it was then a case of, well, the board have got a choice to make. We either keep Mark as captain and move the coach on, or we keep the coach on and admit that we made a mistake with Mark. So as you can imagine, you know which way those things generally play out. So it was time for me to leave. But coming back to your point, while I didn't really change my process, what I had to do was probably shorten to a point where it was in effect.
And the value there that stands out to me is leadership happens from the top down. And if you don't have buy-in, and you know, I see that in my professional life, you know, you can't sell an idea from the bottom up. If the management structure doesn't believe in what you are doing, it's doomed before you start.
Well, that's right. I mean, overall, I think it's a bit of a push-pull. But essentially, if the leaders are not in unison and are not agreed and are fragmented, then it's very difficult to convince anybody else below that whatever the coach thinks should be the direction of the way we go about it. Very hard for them to buy into that, because ultimately they just want to go and play cricket, and they're out in the field with the captain, and therefore they don't want to be in any sort of disagreement with that person who, one, can very much affect their career, could affect their contracts, whatever it might be. So yeah, there's no doubt, you know, in a sporting sense, but any sense, you know, so whether it's the chairman of the board and the CEO, whether it's the CEO and the CFO, or the, you know, the senior leadership team and the leadership team below that, if there is conflict, or if there's fragmentation, or there's tension, or there's not agreement, not alignment, then it creates huge difficulties for the organisation to create a high-performance culture which will sustain itself through good times and bad.
So bloody good lesson to learn before you got the national job.
Yes. No doubt. It still didn't prevent me after I finished the Australian job. I went on to the IPL for two seasons. And in that, I was coach of Calcutta Knight Riders, and Cyril Ganguly was the captain. And as we played this thing called T20 cricket, which was still a new phenomenon, really, and certainly in the Indian environment, with the fireworks mix of Bollywood and star power and lights and broadcasting and so on, It was just a new phenomenon. And we started the first game, was, you know, when Brendan McCullum made 156. And all I remember was there was fireworks on the field and there was fireworks in the sky. And it was just, everybody was alight with this thing called, you know, IPL. Through the course of that season, I really came to the conclusion that a couple of our senior players, which really was one, and Ricky Ponting was another, game had passed by. The game had passed by, certainly from Sirigu's capital, his thinking of the game, from his physical abilities. It needed a different physical capacity that he wasn't able to offer. His batting was more test match cricket than it was T20 cricket. So there's a whole lot of things that I thought we needed Sirigu to occupy a different role rather than captain. And I had that conversation with him. Of course, he wouldn't agree with it. I had that conversation with the owners. They would agree with me till he came in the room, then they would disagree with me. So the next season, I had demoted him from captaincy, and I brought in McCullum and Brad Hodge. And equally, I had the conversation with Reedy Point to say, I don't think this game is made for you now. You know, I think you need to look seriously about, and I have this conversation with each manager as well, I think you need to look seriously about how you get involved with T20 cricket if you go. So we set up this, and Chris Garr was part of the management, our senior leadership group. So we had McCullum, Hodge, Chris Garr, and I had Sirigu in there as well. But on the field, I was leaving the job to McCullum and Hodge. We didn't win a game. We just didn't win a game. And as you can imagine, the owners weren't too pleased, and so that was the end of me coaching LPO. But of course, similar to Middlesex to some degree, but in this case, I could have compromised the way that I was coaching, the way that I was going about the process. And that would be so let him do what he needs to do, and over time, make changes. But to me, that was not the approach, certainly not as I could understand the owners, because the owners want to create this special franchise, and we want to do that. We need to start the best way possible. So it's always an interesting question, I think, for leaders. Coaches, but you're faced with that question a number of times in your career and business life, is that do I sacrifice, compromise my beliefs, principles, values on the basis that I'm going to hang on to this job, I'm going to hang on to this role, or it will lead me to other things, and, you know, if I do make those sacrifices or compromises, that's okay because I'll get them back as I go through this career. And I guess I just believe that once you make that compromise or that sacrifice, you're never getting them back again. And so, much to the chagrin of my wife, I stood on my values and principles. And so, I lost my Middlesex job, I lost the Nightline job, and she's going, "What are you doing? You know, we've got a young family, where's the next job coming from," and so on. But you know, by that stage, I'd start off my kind of success coaching business, and I believe that would be the future, albeit a little bit nice to still bring coaching capacity for the company.
Tell me about your time in the Australian job.
Yes, look, as I said, I'd coached Queensland for 5 years, and I believe there was a shelf life in coaching. And so by that fourth and fifth year, I reckon I'd done just about as much as I could do with the group of players we have, because it was a fairly stable group, young group, and group that would be there for a longer period of time. And so I really believed it was time to hand over to somebody else who could then bring their own style, ideas, processes, systems to build on what we've already started. So fortunately, the Australian job came up because Jeff Marshall left the role, and there was myself and Steve Rickson who were the final two candidates. And I do believe that even though Steve Moore was coming out of the Steve Rickson camp, because obviously he was at last part, Steve was always the person who was taking the road less traveled, which I think you mentioned about your father. And he saw in me somebody that was doing it, probably challenging the way that cricket had been sort of organised and coached. And therefore, I think it was a strong advocate for me to take on the role, which I did. I was given the opportunity in 99, so starting in November 99 in Brisbane, and probably played in that season six test matches against Pakistan, India, number of one days, a dozen or so. Then went to New Zealand, played three tests, another 5 1 days. And coming into that role, I did believe from looking in from outside that it was a good team. They'd won the World Cup in 99, they beat the West Indies, but I just believed that they were still scratching the surface. And of course, we had a few of Queensland boys who were coming in and out, the Australian team back in from Queensland side, and they'd give me a little bit of feedback as to what it was like internally. And so I just believed there was a real opportunity to change things around. And so when I first met them in Brisbane, that was, again, what I wanted to paint them, a picture of Everest. I said, we're going to go on a journey to Everest together, you know. And obviously that conjures up a whole range of things about top of the world, and incredible achievements, risk, hard work, challenge, teamwork, of course. And the Everest was then about changing the way the game was played. So by the time that we would disband as a group, and so I didn't exactly know when that would be, but by the time we disbanded as a group, then we would be given a label, much like the Invincibles had been in 1948, because of what they'd done for cricket. Happy time about changing. So that was kind of the, remember I talked about dreams and pictures and so on, that was part of the dream and the picture. And then I spent that first 9 months or so really looking inside the team and the way that it operated, the individuals, so that I could then present back to Cricket Australia what I believe we need to do to continue to take this team to Everest or peak performance or work.
And as I think about cricket of the 80s, 90s and 00s, and particularly the 80s and 90s, like it was pretty rock and roll, I think it's probably a reasonable way to describe it, because I was a young man in those years and I remember looking at those fellas and just that, you know, they were full-blown rock stars. And I think that, yeah, your ethos and your approach, it does sound like it. Was it reasonably different? Because it does sound a lot more measured, I guess.
Yeah, look, Bobby Simpson took over the Australian team about mid-80s when he was given the manager role to take the second Australian team to New Zealand. And then coming back from that, he was then in the role of manager/coach, and Alan Border was then elevated to the captaincy role. This was after all Rebel tours and a whole range of things that were going on in Australian cricket at the time. And so Bobby Simpson, I think, you know, there's a saying, we're all in a position that we are today because we get to stand on the shoulders of those who've gone before us, you know. And so I was certainly fortunate that it was Bobby Simpson and then there was Jeff Marsh and then it was myself. But basically, yes, they all came from the strong cricket background. Jeff Thompson had been the coach and president, very strong cricket background, new cricket. But in a sense, I always saw that to be my advantage, that I wasn't caught up in the game from a long-term playing perspective. I didn't come to it with these huge credentials of being a great batsman or a great fast bowler or whatever it might have been.
Or drinking 24 beers.
That's right. No. So I very much believe the expertise and the knowledge laying the dressing room. My job was to try to facilitate that and challenge that to be better. And so through data, through different systems, through different processes, trying to look at them as a whole person, not just a creative person, through creating a learning environment that you can challenge them both as a person, but also as a creative being what they were. So that was some of the real inputs that on the outside with players and probably the group at different times, but again, as you said, I was not about to compromise what I believe was the way to go about making this team a far better team than what it was when I started.
And it also sounds to me like you're looking at the longevity of the legacy and the work that you put in. You know, you said, you know, you're not the man who's going to come in with the shield in one go. You're the man who's going to lay the foundation for, you know, a decade of good performance. Am I reading that right?
Yes, that's right. You know, again, I believe that the coach, as I said, one that's shelf life, but in that shelf life, you have to have one foot in the future and one foot in the present. So the future is the dreams, the aspirations, the inspirations of the direction where you want to go. But the foot in the present is that you've got to deal with day to day. You know, you've got to deal with what's in front of us. And if we don't do that, then, you know, as we were saying, if we're going to an area, it's very much driven by results. Sport is driven by the result. That's what it is. You win or you lose. So if all I was doing was believing what I thought was important and we're losing, you know, we had a short tenure. But we're able to get results. And we're able to get results not just because of what I was doing, but because we had a bloody good team as well. So that was always very much about the way I was going about it. And that was, yes, to try to ensure that we were enabling all the players to be as good as they possibly could be. I wanted them to be their own best coach. And most of them were, meaning that they knew pretty well how they got themselves ready to play. And then once they got on their stage, in the main, you know, they knew how they could execute that, how they could deliver that. And that doesn't always guarantee performance, either individually or collectively, but the more of those players who were very confident in their abilities and then how to, as I say, execute those abilities, then that would often give us great competitive advantage over any side of the fight or any tournament that we were involved in. So, yeah, I mean, that was how I wanted to go about it, and that's how I continue to go about it, albeit, you know, we had a few hiccups along the way. 2005 Ashes loss was a big hiccup, and that was a big challenge for me because the board had said, it's time to change the coach. You know, even though we'd been successful for 6 years or so, it was time to move on. You can't lose the points. You know? So I had to reflect very hard upon what I'd been doing and how I'd been going about it, whether I was still the right person. So then you go back to the picture about what the next final 20 months would be like.
Because you went on to do the T20 stuff, that was after, wasn't it? So you've gone there, you've gone on to the end of that, and then, you know, you're stuck here on Star, you're on campus. And you've gone, I'm not going to compromise who I am. And you've started your own business.
Well, it went very well initially, like anything. Once you come out of a successful sporting environment and you're current, then everybody wants to know, wants to hear from you. When I look back now, I wish I knew more about running my own business than I do now. I feel like right now I still don't know how to run my own business. You know, I know a little bit more, but I just really didn't leverage that in the right way back then. And then we were hit by GFC, which really knocked us about as a family and same as a whole lot of other people. So that took me then to New Zealand, where I was director of cricket for a couple of years, and then came back to restart the business again. And, you know, it's been a really interesting journey, generally a pretty successful journey, until, again, like everybody, COVID comes in and throws it out, because, again, a lot of my business was face-to-face, it was speaking, and so on. And so, therefore, yes, you have to work out, well, I have to do it, you know, via Zoom, via other means. But in a sense, I just feel that loses a lot in translation in terms of the way that I go about it. So I'm again now in the transition about the coaching business and how that looks and what that should be, and is it only corporate? I'm really interested now in schools, for that 12 to 17 year old boys or girls. Obviously, I'm just involved with a boys' school, but I think, you know, when I look at the Australian team, those players and what they can do, they could probably be better if their foundations were stronger. One, the game's changing, and two, society's changing. So where do the foundations start? Well, the foundations start in schools. And for the, you know, secondary school boys, or middle school boys, 12 and 17, and if we stayed in cricket, there is so much that can be done in that area to enable those who wish to pursue maybe a cricket career, or those who will learn from cricket and could pursue other careers. There's so much that can be done in there at the moment. So that's what really excites me, running in, if you like, in parallel to the corporate business. And then I'm also involved in a startup in India, which is called Ready, Steady, Go Kids. And it's an Australian program designed for 1.5 to 6-year-olds to introduce them to physical activity in a fun way. And it's a bit like my Aussie Sport Days, except that was for older, slightly older children. So what we've got here is that it's an incredibly well-designed Australian program, very scientifically put together by a professional pediatric physios, therapists, so that it's graduated to facilitate the young child learning how to move through sporting activity. So the 10 different sports, get to sample those in a couple of weeks over a term, and a couple of times a week, possibly, you know. So in a sense, there's a real linkage between, like anything, whether it be academics, whether it be culture, whether it be physical activity, we can get the foundations, solid foundations, down as early as possible. Then it enables the child to experience the next iteration of that. In other words, physical activity will move into more games, and games will move into sport, and sport can move into representative sport, and so on. So if we can get the foundations as solid as possible, as early as possible, it gives them wonderful opportunities to enjoy far more and gain more success from what they're doing. And if they can do that, that hopefully encourages them to be more physically active for a longer period of time. And, of course, you know, the final benefits to society and health and everything else can flow from that as well. So yeah, that's kind of where life is for me at the moment. And, you know, I find it really challenging, because it's they're new businesses, or they're not even businesses at the moment. They're concepts to some degree, although they do have some actual foundation to it. I really must say I do enjoy that challenge, and I enjoy the fact that dealing with younger people, so that their futures, whatever they might be, are given a much better springboard, I think, than maybe what they currently have, whether in Australia or in India.
I think you've painted some pretty clear pictures in your head of where you're going next. you might be still filling in some of the brushwork, but I can certainly see the direction. With your corporate business, who's your ideal client? Who's the sort of person that you'd like to be talking to? Who do you find benefits the most from what you bring to the table?
Well, it's really designed around people who have some sort of leadership or coaching or formal leadership or coaching. So that can be anywhere from CEOs in the leadership team, right down into middle managers, emerging leaders, and so on. I think they're the people that are the real target audience for the corporate business, because one, they have to lead, they have to find a way to lead, they have to find a way to inspire their staff on a daily basis, they have to find a way to continue to understand themselves and how their philosophies, values, and principles impact on other people, and can they improve themselves, do they understand themselves. So I think that, to me, no matter what the industry, those sort of things are just across the board. And so yeah, that's really the target audience. And it's harder for them, in a sense, because they will say, in the main, that I don't have time for this. I'm busy. There's so much going on in my life. There's so much going on at work. I don't have time for this. And in essence, that's really an excuse to not reflect on themselves as leaders and show them that they understand how to do that, and then not only how to do that reflection, but then how to act upon that reflection, and then how to bring that into the workplace, where they have to be probably quite vulnerable at certain stages, which is not an easy place to be or a comfortable place for anybody.
That sounds pretty wonderful. John, before we wrap up, because I'm conscious of your time, is there anything else you're interested in touching on today?
I think we've touched on those things.
Mate, we've been pretty thorough here, but I just wanted to give you that chance before I...
I should probably just touch on my family.
Yes, please, because, mate, geez, they've been pretty busy along the way.
Well, again, that's very true. You know, so... going right back to the days where, as I said, I was a professional cricketer in England, and that's where my wife to be came for the first time. And she's been with me ever since. So, you know, we've now been 43 years married and probably about 46 years together. Like it's an old cliche, but behind every man, there's not only a good woman, but and maybe this is not politically correct these days, but it's my life, and so that's correct. She's been incredible in terms of her support, but her ability to maintain the household, because here I am as a career coach for 16 years, on the road a heck of a lot. And we have five children. So somehow she managed to raise these five children in every week. They're all doing different sports, and different requirements at school. So there's from morning to evening, and then the weekends turn up, and then there's school sport on, there's club sport on. So she's there faring and managing the whole shift. And so we have, everybody, I'm sure every family feels like a pretty children, or five put in children, to be honest. Boy Michael, who played cricket for Queensland, played rugby, schoolboy rugby for Australia. He's now commercial manager for ACT cricket, just recently started. Our daughter, who's number two in line, probably won't give all their ages away, but we say there's roughly 2 or 3 years in between each. She's a dermatologist. And I've put an incredible amount of time to gain that degree in gain those credentials and qualifications. And she's got three beautiful granddaughters, and how she managed to do all that. And obviously, married to a very good husband who's helped her through thick and thin. And then our next boy who played a game of rugby for Queensland, captain university club for a number of years, and also East in Sydney, just an incredible leader. And he's now moved on to a senior role with Emirates Airlines in terms of marketing events and sponsorship in the area, but in Sydney. And now number four, this is a long story in itself, isn't it? Nicholas, who is an outstanding athlete. I mean, he was probably a combination of Michael and Tim, and got the best of all of them. Played rugby for Australian schoolboys, played cricket for Queensland, but was beset by just one injury after another, which is so unfortunate because when he played, played in Australian and the World Cup cricket, so the likes of Mitchell Marsh and Hazelwood, a couple of others international cricket. He's now doing a bit of career coaching. He's got a wonderful career with a company called Arthrex and their medical supplies and working in sports medicine with operating surgeons and so on. So, yeah, and his partner, soon to be married, she's an incredible fine woman, Courtney Hancock, who's been the Coolangatta Gold Queen for so many years, and just one of the all-time greats of the part of surf lifesaver. And then our youngest, Elise, she is actually with Courtney right at the moment. They've both gone to Perth because the Australian surf lifesaving titles are on. And she, with the Currumbin Hunters, she's into surf boat rowing, so she's represented Australia. They're the current Queensland champions. And she's involved in another medical equipment course, company called Striker. So, you know, that sounds, in a sense, here we are playing in a trumpet, but all of them, you know, they became part of the cricket journey at different stages of their lives, whether it be Queensland or Australia. And really just loved the environment, but I'm sure it was harder for our eldest boy, Michael, because he was really playing around that time, and so there were always probably expectations on him. But nonetheless, they all managed to really enjoy their time around that environment, but it didn't affect them in any way, and it gave them some, you know, wonderful memories, great family memories for all of us. And so now that they're exploring their own careers and really making a huge success.
And that partnership you choose for yourself is one that's pretty important, isn't it? The person you choose to spend your life with is an important decision.
It is. It is. And, you know, I was just very fortunate that happened. It happened on a blind date, as a matter of fact. And but I was one of the lucky ones.
And I feel the same way in my relationship. So, is it the yin and yang we talk about in my household? Because I'm spinning off the planet somewhere and she is ruthlessly organized. And mate, without her, I wouldn't be sitting here now. She's the one who gave me a good, well-paying job. And I said, I'd like to quit and start my own job and not make any money.
That's right.
And she said, I believe in you. And let me assure you, mate, the scoreboard didn't read real good for a long time, and she still believed.
Yeah, so important, so important. Yeah, as I said, I couldn't have done what I did without my wife Judith being the rock and the backbone behind all this.
What a beautiful way to wind this up. John, if people want to get in touch with you, if they're interested in some performance coaching, everything that you bring to the table, where's the best way to find you?
Yes, yeah, so probably the website's the easiest place, so buchanancoaching.com. And the other way, I use LinkedIn quite a bit, so they can find me either John Buchanan on LinkedIn or they can go to Buchanan Success Coaching on LinkedIn. I'm not a huge Facebooker, and, you know, I've got the links, Instagram and all that sort of stuff, but those, the website and LinkedIn, are probably the easiest places.
They're the ones to get you. And what I'll do is I'll pop those in the show notes so that people could just click on those. John, I'd like to say a very big thank you. I'm delighted to have had you as a guest this morning, and I really appreciate you sharing that journey with us today.
Love it, Scott. Thanks very much.
Thank you, mate. All right, well, that's it. We'll catch you next time.